This morning I'm going to introduce the whole sutta, give you a bit of an overview, what it's all about, what the form is, what the structure is, and so on. And then over the rest of the retreat, we'll be diving into different aspects of the retreat. So this is a kind of big picture introduction. And then hopefully when we come to do the specific aspects of it, you'll understand where it fits into the overall context. If you want to do any reading, these are two very good books. So there's Anālio's book, Satipatthana, the Direct Path to Realization. And then there's Bhante's Living with Awareness, which is his sort of commentary on the sutta. So these are the two Bibles that I'd recommend you read. And they're good to dip into during the week if you want to do any background reading. But on that note, actually, it's interesting on a retreat like this to reduce input. Yeah, because what we're doing is we're looking at our own mind, our own heart, our own reactions, our own tendencies, coming closer and closer to this bundle of habits that we call ourselves. And if we have little outside input, then the kind of turning the mirror on ourselves, it becomes purer and clearer, and we can see ourselves more directly. So in that vein, I think tomorrow we'll shut the bookshop up, or we'll pull the blinds down, so you won't even see the books on the way past. So the grasping mind that goes like that every time you walk past will just be seeing a blank blind, a nice white aesthetic blind. And I'm not saying don't read, but I'm saying think about it. And some of us are compulsive readers. Yeah. Some of us find ourselves reading the cereal boxes at breakfast. Yeah. So we've become true experts on all the ingredients in the soy milk and the cereal and so on. And I think if you're a compulsive reader, then having a bookshop, it's not helpful, because you're just going to be drawn to it. And you just, it's like eating. You know, we can use words like junk food sometimes. So I would be, ask yourself, do I need to read? And if you feel reading will be helpful, see if it can be what we call spiritual reading rather than consumptive reading. So read something that is actually going to raise your consciousness and educate you in a helpful way. Yeah, so reducing input is a big part of what we're trying to do, which is why we have silence, why we come away from our normal lives, why we sort of unplug from the outside world, so that we get this opportunity to see into our own nature with much more purity and clarity. So the overall context and approach is really very beautiful, I find. I love this text. It's pure, it's simple, it describes how we can free our own minds and our own hearts in very systematic, clear, practical ways. It's a very practical sutta. And the overall context is that we are aligning ourselves with the natural way of things. Yeah. So we're aligning ourselves with reality, we're aligning ourselves with the way things are. And the approach of this sutta is that we kind of relax into that. We do need to put effort in, obviously, just to kind of work on our more unskillful habits. But the overall thrust is that the natural way of things is here right now. Reality is here right now. The potential for awakening is here right now. And it's as if that's, what would be an image? That's a clear blue sky. And then all of our habits, our mental habits, our sangskaras, what we brought from the past, they're like turbulent clouds. And usually what we do is we identify with the turbulent clouds as if that's all there is. If you've been in a plane, you know, when you're going through the clouds, it's very interesting, isn't it? It's as if that's all there is. You look out the window and it's just these great cumulus clouds and so on. And sometimes they're black, sometimes they're white. But as if that is all there is in that moment. And then you break out of that and there's the clear blue sky. And of course, the clear blue sky had been there all along. But when you're in the clouds, you don't know that. So our normal way of living is in that point where you're flying through the clouds and you just think that's all there is. What the Buddha's saying is that those clouds, those habits, that way of being, That isn't all there is. In fact, that is a delusion. And identifying with it is the source of all our suffering. And what we can learn to do instead is to identify with the clear blue sky of the mind. And just let the clouds be there, let them come, let them go. So it's a very interesting approach to the spiritual life, where we're both relaxing into something innate, and we are also putting in the work of changing our habits. So we're not identifying with the clouds, but we're releasing the clouds. So it's a very interesting kind of effort, and we'll do some work around balanced effort during the retreat. You know, how do you actually do that? How do you apply intention, apply effort, but the effort is in order to relax rather than the effort to grasp onto something different. We're learning to disidentify with what we are experiencing, the conditioned arising. Usually what we do is identify with that as if it is the only thing. So you're having an angry state, you think, I am anger. Well, you don't even think that, you just are anger. And it feels incredibly solid and real, doesn't it? With Satipatthana practice, you're learning to rest back and to note the arising and passing of an angry emotion. That's very different from being an angry person. You know, you're a person with the potential for awakening who's having a passing angry emotion. So another way Anālya talks about it, he says sati, which is mindfulness, is the middle way between suppression and reaction. So we're learning how to balance those two responses to life. Yeah. Breath works, we talk about the middle way between blocking and drowning, which is a similar kind of thing. So some of us are habitual blockers. So something comes along and we just turn away. Yeah? I don't want that. And some of us are more inclined to drown, which is we just fall into whatever arises and we get overwhelmed. So the middle way between denial and overwhelm is another way of talking about this middle way between suppression and reaction. Yeah. And hopefully during this week, you'll get a lot more agile at catching the arising of either one of those two habitual responses of denial or overwhelm. And my suggestion is we're all doing both of those all the time. So another part of Satipatthana contemplation is we don't judge ourselves. We don't think, I'm doing it all wrong because I'm feeling angry. You think, how interesting. This is what anger feels like. This is anger. I note the arising of anger. I note the passing away of anger. So there's not this, I shouldn't be having anger because I'm a Buddhist in the ordination process and I should be beyond that. You know, we can easily get into that kind of idealism where we think we shouldn't be having what we are having. And then we haven't only got the emotion, but then we've got judgment of the emotion and suppression of the emotion, and then we've got a whole other can of worms. Yeah. So it's a very sort of liberating approach where we're open. It's a bit like an image I like is we're resting back in an armchair. And it's like, come on, life, you know, bring it on. So there's this confidence, this stability, balance, poise, so that life can no longer throw you off course. And of course, if you have a very narrow idea of the path that I shouldn't be having any negative emotion, then you're going to be thrown off course. Every time a negative emotion comes in, you're going to be not sideways. But if it's like, yeah, I'm human, I'm going to have negative emotions. Here it comes, here it arises, here it passes away. Here's a positive emotion, it arises, passes away. And I'm in touch with a quality of consciousness which has something of the blue sky. That's beautiful. It's really beautiful. So it's a very stable, broad, balanced, poised quality that we're cultivating in Satipatthana contemplation. And it was very good doing that work, not work, that play last night around intention. Because if you look at the top of this, page 4, where I'm suggesting that we all want to be free, and this sutta rests on that sort of assumption, you wouldn't engage with it if you didn't want to be free. The fact that we're all here, there's something in each of us that is longing for a non-reactive heart and a free mind, or else we wouldn't be here. And I would confidently assume that every single intention last night was based on that longing. 26 variations on that theme will be sitting on the shrine in there. Yeah. And it's lovely that we've all identified our own particular doorway into that. But having established that intention at the beginning of the retreat, we can rest in that confidence that I long to be free and I can be free. And all these teachings that we're going to be dwelling in over this retreat are all in aid of that longing for freedom. And that's a very clear path that the Buddha's laying out about how we can move closer and closer to that. So it's really great that we did that. We set our intentions last night and they're on the shrine at the feet of the Buddha. And that we can rest in that confidence. So confidence is a very important part of practice, isn't it? And often faith is also translated as confidence, shraddha, faith, confidence. So I just really exhort you all to be confident in your confidence. Yeah, we're all confident enough to be here. We're confident enough to make our way in there and sit on the cushion, sit at the feet of the Buddha, and rest in our own longing for freedom. Our longing to be a force for good in the world rather than a destructive force in the world. And because one of the central teachings of the Buddha is this idea of conditionality, that rather than life being fixed and static, it's a flow, just flowing through us all the time. It's a rising and passing of conditions. Yeah. Conditions that are material, emotional, mental, gravity, biochemistry. It's all happening. So this form that I have here that's got this name, Vidyamala, is in fact very, very alive and dynamic. And there is nothing fixed and static. It's a flow. And the way that flow moves into the next moment, to some extent, depends on my state of mind in this moment. Not completely, because I've got biochemical things and physical things going on that my state of mind can't necessarily, my state of mind isn't going to unfuse my spine. That's quite an important point as well, because sometimes we think we can change everything with our minds. We can't, but we can change our ethical behavior and we can change the quality of our consciousness with our minds. So using that principle that life is a flow, every single moment we're making choices mentally, choices emotionally, choices with our speech when we're speaking, choices with our internal speech when we're not speaking out loud, our sort of inside talk, that sets up the conditions for how our life unfolds. So the Buddha's saying by choosing to dwell upon that within us, which has the seeds of release, we become a person who becomes conditioned to be moving towards freedom. Yeah. So all the time we can choose what we do with our awareness, what we do with our attention. And we're going to be teaching you quite subtle skills during this retreat to identify the already existent seeds of release within us that are always there, to notice them, to catch them, to rest there, to dwell there, and then they will quite naturally bloom into positive emotion. Yeah, and that's another lovely skill to learn, because I think sometimes, say with something like the metta bhavana, we can feel like we're trying to generate positive emotion from nothing. Do you know what I mean? It can feel quite forced, and a bit like trying to squeeze something out of an empty toothpaste tube. The lovely thing about this approach to practice is rather than generating something from nothing, you find within you what's already there, which has the seeds of positive emotion, and you choose to rest there, and then using the law of conditionality, what we dwell on we become, positive emotion will quite naturally arise. So on the Vedana day, we're going to do some lovely exercises around that, how to understand how positive emotion is also conditioned, and where does it start from, and how do we catch those little moments. So according to the Buddha, if we practice in this way, we will become enlightened. It's not we might, or it's not if we're lucky. It will happen because of this law of conditionality. Yeah, by choosing what we do with our awareness and our consciousness, we will move in the direction of freedom. And I can guarantee each one of us will have moved a little bit further at the end of these 10 days. I think I said that on the first night, didn't I? So I promised that twice now. It's kind of risky. But I do feel very confident that that will be true. Yeah. And it might not be pleasant, but it will be true. So let's begin to look at the whole sutta now. So if we go back to page one. So sati is one of the words for mindfulness. It means something like bare awareness. So it's sati is the quality of being really present right now with whatever we're experiencing. And upatthana is something like to be present with or placing near. Yeah, so to we're placing near mindfulness, or we've been present with mindfulness. And some various ways it's translated is the four ways of attending mindfully, the four presences of mindfulness, the four ways of establishing mindfulness, and the four ways to develop the mind of a Buddha. Sometimes satipatthana, people talk about the four satipatthanas, our body, vedana, citta and dhammas, as if they're things, but the scholars seem to agree it's more on the process. So the four ways of becoming mindful. And in some other suttas, there are different objects. So they're not always the same four objects of awareness, but it's the process of awareness. And the four satipatthanas in this sutta of body, feeling, citta and dhammas, they're four doorways into the quality of awareness. Yeah. But actually anything probably could be a satipatthana. But they're extremely good doorways, as we all discover. The Buddha has given us these doorways based on his own journey and his own enlightenment. And then looking back, he's given this teaching to us, saying, you too can pass through these doorways. And you too can know freedom of mind and freedom of heart. And it's called the direct path to overcome dukkha. Yeah. So it's a very important text, very widely practiced text, seen by many people to be the root text on mindfulness in the Buddhist tradition. Yeah. So it's really great that Taraloka offers this retreat for all of us, because it's such a central text. I think any of us who are wanting to practice in our tradition, ideally we'd be really familiar with this sutta. We'd almost know it by heart. Yeah, I mean, I don't know it by heart in Pali, but I've got so familiar with it in terms of what it's teaching that it's at my fingertips, and that's a lovely thing in daily life to have that. So ideally we'd all have it at our fingertips as a map of awakening. And we're going to read the sutta out later this morning. And at the end, he says, if you follow the sutta, you'll gain enlightenment in 7 years, no 7 months, no 7 weeks, indeed in 7 days, you will gain enlightenment. So we've got 10 days. So we've got time for a few down days. We can have some off days, and we'll still have realized the direct path at the end of the week, at the end of the 10 days. And Anālaya, he's quite brilliant. He's come up with this lovely summary, the four-word summary of this rather long sutta. And the four-word summary is keep calmly knowing change. So if there's one thing you remember from this talk, just remember that. Keep, which has got this quality of continuity. Keep on the path, sustain your awareness. So it's moment-by-moment awareness through the moments. Yeah. So that continued application of awareness and effort. Calmly, that's becoming free from being driven by desires and aversions to experience. You could say that this middle way I've already introduced between denial and overwhelm, if we've tread the middle way, we're calm. You know, we haven't got the sort of pressure of suppression, and we haven't got the turbulence of overwhelm. We're calm, we're balanced, we're poised. Yeah. So that's the calmly aspect. Knowing, a quality of intelligent awareness. This is quite interesting. So awareness isn't just a kind of neutral awareness, but we're using our intelligence to interpret our awareness in a way, in the service of our longing for freedom. Yeah. So we might become aware of anger, and then we use our intelligence to know that and to let it go. Yeah. So, I mean, you could become aware of anger and think, oh, great, anger, I'll become more angry. Yeah. That will be a kind of unintelligent response. So we're using our discernment to, in terms of how do we relate to that which is arising moment by moment. So it's becoming aware that we're aware. So we're aware of awareness, which is self-reflexive awareness. And then change, very, very important, which is insight into the true nature of things. Yeah, and impermanence, this word impermanence, anicca. Bhante has said that in one of his early talks, I think it's between the twin sala trees, he says if all of the texts of Buddhism could be boiled down to one word, that one word would be impermanence. Yeah. And Subhuti also says that the whole of the Buddha's teaching is contained in this word, impermanence, anicca. Yeah. So it's quite strongly brought out in the sutta, of course. And it's one of the lakshanas, one of the marks of conditioned existence. And the other two are insubstantiality and unsatisfactoriness. And as soon as you become aware of impermanence, by implications, you're also becoming aware of insubstantiality. In the sense, everything's changing, even me. There is no fixed self. So it's not like you just look out into the world outside and see change, but you don't apply that teaching to yourself. You too are change. And then everything we experience in life is unsatisfactory because we don't get that. So we want the nice things to last, and they don't. We're always clinging on to life, or we're pushing life away. When we're pushing painful things away, we're also pushing it away because we think it's something solid, whereas actually it's just like water flowing through our fingers. So when we live with more insight, with more understanding of the lakshanas, we have open hands. It's a lovely sort of gesture, this mudra. And we're just allowing life to flow through our fingers. We're not grasping or pushing away. Because hands are very interesting, aren't they? Very expressive of our mental states. And I think I said in the body scan yesterday that the fingers are so interesting. Because I think when the mind is in the future, there is a subtle reaching in the fingers. And when the mind is in the past, there's a subtle holding on. So if we really soften the fingers, we also soften the mind. So the fingers are such an interesting expression of what our mind is doing. So during the day, you could just check in on your fingers every now and then and see if they're reaching that sort of longing, or are they holding on to something. Soften the fingers, soften the mind. It's brilliant. So we're learning to live with flow. Okay. So moving on to the actual structure of the sutta. It's got a very interesting structure. It's very dramatic. Yeah, I love this about this sutta. It's got a very interesting shape, let's call it that. And it's cumulative, so it's a progressive sutta. So at the very beginning, you've got the definition verse, and you just get that verse once, and it's setting the scene. And the definition verse is telling us the attitudes to bring to all of our Satipatthana contemplation. So saying, right at the start, set your intention, set your attitudes in order to then flow into your awareness practice. So it's asking us for appropriate effort. Yeah, the usual translation is diligence, which I think's fine, but some of us can misinterpret diligence and think it's a bit willed and strained, but it's a balanced effort. Yeah. And I think we will do some little exercises around balanced effort during the week, because that's quite a tricky area for many of us. We're either trying too hard or we're drifting off. And if you strain, eventually you'll get bored of straining, and then you'll have a little daydream. Maybe you'll even go to sleep, and then you'll wake yourself up, and then you'll go back to straining again. Yeah. Yeah. So balanced effort is very, very interesting. You do a whole retreat just on balanced effort. And the Qigong is brilliant for that, because, of course, that's all about balanced effort and flow and being in the body. Next, attitude is intelligence and clarity applied to what is coming through the senses. Yeah. Sampajana, very important word. And that includes this quality of continuity and purpose. So it's applying intelligence in the light of the goal, what we're moving towards in relation to what's coming through our senses. So as I said before, if you notice that you're angry, rather than thinking, yippee, I'm angry, I'm going to really stoke myself up over the next half hour, that would be unaware. You think, anger, here it is. You don't judge it, but you let it go. Because your goal is to be less in the grip of unskillful and more in the flow of the skillful. So another way it's sometimes talked about is being self-possessed. So it's the opposite of being drunk. So it's ability to comprehend what's taking place. And what's interesting about Sampajana is it's not passive. It's quite an active quality. It's an alert state of mind. And you're using this discernment to choose kind of what do you do with what's arrived in the moment. How can you release that which is unskillful and cultivate that which is skillful? And then we've got sati, which is knowing right now. And interestingly, in the texts, in the Buddhist tradition, sati sampajana is very often a compound term. So they come together. Yeah, and I'll just read you what Bhante says about that, because it's really interesting. So he calls sampajana clear comprehension of purpose. So he says, despite their different emphases, mindfulness and clear comprehension of purpose often appear as a compound term in Pali, sati sampajana, and the two words can be considered to be so close in meaning as to be virtually interchangeable. There is no precise word in English for this kind of recollection, and it's difficult to come up with a definition that evokes its spirit. One might say that it is going about one's daily life without ever forgetting one's higher purpose. Yeah, so that's nice, isn't it? It's quite a clear description. And then he says, the subtle interplay between awareness and recollection has the effect of integrating one's whole experience and continually re-establishing a sense of harmony and direction. Sati Sampajana has a balancing and integrating quality that permeates every area of experience. To bring about a whole way of life concentrated not so much on a future goal as on the dynamic, cumulative nature of the path itself. Yeah, so that's lovely, isn't it? That's page 23 of this book. And then the fourth attitude in the Satipatthana Sutta is letting go of being a slave to likes and dislikes. That's nice, isn't it? Yeah. A little bit what I talked about on the first evening about letting go of preferences. And in fact, I think we've got the scaffolding noise happening today, haven't we? So we've got a lovely opportunity to just notice sound arising. That's not nearly disturbing enough, is it? It's a little bit disappointing from that point of view. We can go over there and get them to be a bit more noisy. Can you put on Radio 1, please? Yeah. So we're setting aside rejection and acceptance and coming to wholeness. And Analio describes it as having removed desires and discontent, which I think is also very nice. Free from desires and discontent in regard to the world. Yeah, imagine being free of discontent. Wouldn't that be amazing? It's quite hard to imagine, but lovely. Okay, so you at the very beginning of the sutta, you have these four qualities being evoked, and the Buddha's saying, please bring these attitudes to your Satipatthana practice. If you want to wake up, you must have these qualities. Yeah, it's quite assertive. He's certainly not saying just drift around for 10 days. He's saying bring these attitudes to bear on your experience and then relax. Very interesting, that kind of koan. And then we've got the four objects of awareness, which is being aware of the body, being aware of sensations, being aware of the shape of your heart and mind, your mood, the sort of broad emotional qualities that you have present. And being aware of dhammas, which one way of you, of describing that is the content of the mind, your mental and emotional events seen from the perspective of the dhamma. Yeah, I'll say more about that in a minute. And those are more progressively more refined. So the body is the grossest level of awareness, and then the subtle passing of mental and emotional states is obviously very fleeting and slippery. In terms of the relationship between chitta and dhammas, one way you can look at that is chitta is as if you're at the top of a mountain looking down on a scene. Yeah, so you've got quite a broad perspective on the landscape. And then dhammas is you look down on that same landscape with a pair of binoculars and you focus in on the actual specific elements that are dotted around on the plane. Sorry? Binoculars are those things that you have if you're looking at a bird or something. Mm. So they magnify. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So dhammas has got, the dhammic perspective is quite sharp and clear. Mm. It's not vague. So you know, you're really beginning to tease apart the flow of experience so you can come closer to it. And then, dramatically, this is very interesting, between each section and the sutta, you've got what's called the chorus or the refrain. And I think of this as being like a big drum beat. So he's telling you to set up your attitudes, beware of the body, and then this big sort of drum comes in and tells you to use awareness of your body in that instance to develop insight in the following ways. And the first way is to become aware of that experience. Let's just talk about the body for a minute, assuming we're in the body section. We're aware of it internally and externally, and that's generally understood to be being aware of it in yourself and being aware of it in other people. And I like that particular interpretation because it takes it away from being a very sort of selfish, self-centered practice. So we're going to use it that way this week. I have a body, you have a body, we're interconnected, we're similar. You know, we're not separate and isolated from one another. Then we're asked to be aware of the arising and the passing away. So this is impermanence and by implication, insubstantiality and unsatisfactoriness. So be aware that this thing that you're paying attention to is impermanent. It has no fixed essence. And then we're asked to cultivate mindfulness enough for bare knowledge and continuous mindfulness, which means don't get caught up with the experience. So going back to you're flying through the clouds and you see, well, there's a big puffy cumulus cloud. You note it, but you don't then obsess about the nature of the cumulus cloud, which one can, actually, because clouds can be so amazing when you're flying through them. You just note it, yeah? And you stay centered and balanced and poised while you're looking at whatever's there. So don't become caught up with experience. And then we abide independent, not clinging to anything in the world. Yeah, so that's the highest level. So mindfulness is cultivated and sustained without any clinging, simply for the sake of gaining enlightenment. So that's your highest purpose. So you're not becoming mindful to have a good life. You're becoming mindful to gain enlightenment, to be completely free. So this is quite interesting because in the mindfulness world, you often have discussions like, is a sniper mindful? A sniper is very, very present. You know, if you're a sniper, you're completely in your body. You'd be aware of your breath, focused, aware of the wind direction, aware of what you're going to shoot. So you could say highly present, highly mindful. But a sniper would be driven by greed or aversion or a desire to kill. So you could say there's clinging there. So that's the difference between mindfulness that we're cultivating for the sake of enlightenment and just being really present in worldly life. It's what's your underlying purpose? What's your aim? So I would say a sniper isn't mindful in the full Buddhist sense, because the sniper's goal is very different from the goal of someone we're wanting to align themselves with reality. Yeah. Okay, so moving to the next page, which is where we chunk it down even more. So within the body section, there are six subsections. Yeah. So we're being asked to be aware of the breath. We're being asked to be aware of the four postures, which is sitting, walking, standing, and lying down. And as I said on the first night, by implication, any posture. So we're being asked to be aware of the body at all times. We're being asked to be aware of the body in all activities. And the Buddha lists walking, wearing robes, carrying the bowl, eating, drinking, going to the toilet, falling asleep, waking up, talking, and being silent. So that's quite a comprehensive list, isn't it? And I think we would add in things like being on Facebook, for example, emails, computer addiction, whatever it might be. We're asked to be aware of the body parts, and it goes through quite a detailed breakdown of sinew, pus, snot, bones, moisture, etc. You'll hear all that when we go into the shrine room. And in a way, I think the point of that is we so identify with the body as being a thing. So we're being asked to, the image is that it's like a sack of grain with a hole at each end. That's one of the images he uses, which is brilliant, isn't it? A sack of grain with a hole at each end. That's what we are. So we're just chunking it all down. And then we're asked to be aware of the body being composed of the elements, earth, water, fire, and air, which is even more breaking it down. So tears are just the water element. Yeah. Bone is the earth element. And then finally, we're being asked to be aware of the body as a corpse. So it's just imagining a corpse. This body that I'm so identified with one day will be a skeleton, and then the skeleton will rot, and then there'll be nothing left. It will just be dust. Yeah. So it's very powerful reflections. We're going to focus mainly on breath, posture, and activities. We're not particularly going to go into the dismemberment aspect of the sutta. For a few reasons, I think it's not so necessary, but also I think in the West, we're so nihilistic. You know, I think we're kind of lacking in faith, a lot of us, and sense of sort of moving towards something beautiful. A lot of us are very influenced by scientific, materialistic attitudes to life. So when a skeleton all rots away, well, there's nothing, and it's a big black hole. That's not a helpful reflection for many of us. So we're not going to go there. We're going to focus much more on cultivating faith this week. And we're going to be aware of breath, postures, and activities within that context. But you will hear, when we read the sutta, we're going to read out those bits, so you will hear how graphic they are. And then the next area is Vedana, which is difficult to translate. It's sometimes translated as feeling, but I don't personally find that very helpful, because in English, feeling is such a broad word. And what's meant is the raw, bare experience. The initial arising of a raw, bare experience that is pleasant, painful, or neutral. Yeah. So it's not feeling angry. That's in the realm of citta. So it's where would the anger start? The anger would have started with some flicker in the body. So we're being asked to catch that very first flicker. Yeah, that's and it's such an important part of Satipatthana practice. And in some ways, I think Vedana is the real working ground, because you're getting closer and closer and closer to where an experience starts. And if you can catch that, you can then rest upon the Vedana that's going to take you up the path, and you can let go of the Vedana that's going to take you into reaction. Yeah, so we're going to do a whole day on that in a few days. And he says that there are these two kind of classes of Vedana, worldly, unworldly, or materialistic, spiritual. Yeah. So there's certain Vedana that has a latent tendency to stimulate greed, hatred, and delusion. And if you follow that Vedana, you are going to go backwards on the path. Yeah. So there's classic sort of examples that people talk about where you like cake, you're going past a cake shop. Before you know it, you're eating a cake. You don't know how that happened. But there was a visual sense. You walked past, you saw the cake. There was a pleasant Vedana, that you acted on and you've got craving, desire, and then you're eating the cake. Nothing wrong with eating cake, I hasten to add. But let's just say that on that day you were trying not to eat cake. So you had an intention not to eat cake, and then how on earth have I just eaten this piece of cake? That started with a visual impression, followed by a Vedana that you missed. Yeah. Same with, you know, when you find yourself in an argument. Where did that come from? It started with a Vedana. You probably saw somebody that you're fed up with. There was a visual impression, or there was an unpleasant arising in the body, just something. You didn't catch it, and before you know it, you're into a full-blown reaction. Yeah. Neutral Vedana is interesting. You know, I've been doing this work for more than a decade, and I still don't really know what it is. It can be that which isn't either pleasant or unpleasant. But in my experience, as soon as you become aware of Vedana, it seems to be either pleasant or unpleasant. So it could be all the Vedana that you're not noticing. So you could say, real work is to kind of defrost all those kind of icy landscapes of your emotional life that you're just not aware of. And that within that, there's going to be lots of Vedana that you can then catch and become familiar with. But the broad thing of worldly Vedana is it's that which is going to lead you into a reactive state of mind. So, and it will always have something of greed, hatred and delusion within it. Yeah. So another way of understanding neutral Vedana is it's got some kind of ignorance in it, some kind of delusion in it. Then there's this very interesting area of unworldly Vedana, or spiritual Vedana. What is that? This is Vedana that is free of the latent tendency to stimulate the poisons. And it leads to progress on the path. So an example would be you're meditating and you get some kind of opening around the heart. I'm sure we've all had that. And it's pleasant, isn't it? There's that kind of just something that's happening that's in the body. That would be unworldly pleasant Vedana. And the Buddha's saying, stay with it. With the worldly Vedana, he's saying, let it go. With unworldly Vedana, he's saying, stay with it. Rest there. And allow it to blossom into positive emotion. Yeah. Unpleasant, unworldly Vedana, apparently, is dissatisfaction with one's spiritual imperfection. Very interesting. So it's this sense that there's always more to do. And if we don't have that, we won't be motivated to practice. So it's that sense that there's always more to learn. And I was just reading an Analia before, and he's saying that in the text, it says that after the Buddha gained enlightenment, he still practiced Satipatthana. Yeah. And the Arahant still practiced Satipatthana. It never ends. So it's this idea that it never ends. Because if you think there's nothing more to do, well, you're just going to go to sleep again probably, aren't you? It's a tricky one because dissatisfaction with our spiritual imperfection can become something we beat ourselves with. And we get very kind of strained and willful and judgmental and give ourselves a hard time. Again, very Western preoccupation. You know, we're very good at giving ourselves a hard time. And it's possible in some other cultures that's not such a tendency. So we need to be a little bit careful. I wouldn't want you to be sitting there beating yourselves up because you're imperfect the next 10 days. But I would want you to have this curiosity. There's always more. And something that I've found very fascinating about spiritual life is whenever I think I've got somewhere, 6 months later, I'll have another experience and I'll think I didn't know anything 6 months ago. So I've kind of learned to not really assess my practice in terms of where am I on the path. So I think where I'm at now is I just need to have confidence that there is growth happening. That's enough, actually. I just need to be confident that there's transformation occurring and I'm becoming more aware and more kind. Okay, and then neutral, unworldly Vedana is what arises in concentration. And I think it's a very high level of equanimity. Yeah, when you're just completely still, completely clear, and there isn't any movement towards or away from, that would be neutral Vedana. It hasn't got any movement either towards the pleasant or away from the unpleasant. What's very interesting, and you'll of course all know this from your Mitra study and the Wheel of Life and the Nidana chain, is that body and Vedana are what are called resultant. So in terms of karma and resultant, they arise as a result of a previous moment. So we can't do anything about the body and the Vedana aspect in this moment, because they've just arrived in our experience because of an action we took a moment ago. So if I try and unpack that a wee bit, here I am, I'm sitting here. This body is the way it is to some extent because of previous actions. To some extent it's other levels of conditionality at work. But here it is. You know, I can't sort of suddenly have a different body. It's here. It's in this moment. And the Vedana that I'm experiencing right now, it's here. It's arrived. Yeah, I can't sort of go back in time and think, oh, I want to have different Vedana in that moment. You can't do that. I've already had the past moments and here it is. I've got a body, I've got Vedana. And what the Buddha's saying is that there's a very important choice point between results and action. So how I act in this moment, that's a choice, that's active. And that will set up conditions for the next moment. And citta is active. So citta is something that we can act in this moment. We're actively choosing. I mean, it's not conscious, but it's something that we're generating in this moment. It's our emotions, yeah? Which is why becoming aware of body and Vedana is so important, because choosing how we respond to what has already arrived, that is the point of the unfolding of our spiritual life. So we've got ordinary and higher citta in the sutta. So ordinary includes the wholesome and the unwholesome. So it's the present. We become aware of the presence or absence of lust, the presence or absence of anger, presence or absence of delusion, whether our mind is contracted, which is sloth and torpor, or distracted, which is restlessness. So that's very interesting, because we need to find balance between those two aspects. So a pleasant worldly Vedana not caught will lead to desire. An unpleasant worldly Vedana will lead to some kind of aversion. It's just the way of things. Yeah. And then the higher states of mind, being aware you've got a great mind, an unsurpassable mind, a concentrated mind, or a liberated mind. Yeah. And the Buddha is saying if we can stay with the unworldly Vedana, the spiritual Vedana, then these much, much more expansive states of mind will naturally arise. What we dwell on, we become. Yeah. So if we stick with the worldly, the ordinary, we end up with more suffering. And if we are able to follow the unworldly, the higher, then we end up with freedom. And that's what's so exciting about the sutta, because that's not magic. It's not luck. It is conditionality at work. It's how things are. It really is that simple. Difficult to do, but simple to understand. Yeah, what we dwell on, we become. And then there's the Dhamma section, which is a very interesting section, because really it's about conditionality. So this is the only section that goes into conditionality in a lot of depth. The other sections, you're kind of aware of the presence or the absence of something. But in the Dhamma section, you're not only aware of the presence or absence of, say, the hindrances, but you're aware of what conditions contributed to this experience. In the case of a hindrance, how can I prevent the future arising? And in the case of a positive state, like an awakening factor, how can I create conditions to allow the future arising? So it's a bit like the four right efforts in the Dhamma section. So it's seeing phenomena as they are represented in the mind from a Dharmic perspective. So it's really hammering home the Dharmic perspective and conditionality through the Dharma section. And there's a list of different teachings. There's the five hindrances, the five skandhas, the six sense spheres, the seven awakening factors, and the four noble truths. I'm going into all this because I find it really fascinating, and I hope that you do. But also, I think if you're, you know, you're really serious about the Buddhist path and you're serious about wanting to get ordained into our tradition, this is such good Dharma. You know, this is really going to build your Dharma knowledge. And Dharma knowledge is really important, isn't it, to understand the teachings that the Buddha gave us. So you're getting a really juicy bit of Dharma in this text. There's a lot in it. You know, it's got the lakshanas, it's got the gap between feeling and craving. You know, that's the point of Vedana. Choosing how you respond to your Vedana, that's in there. It's got all these lists. It's always good to know the lists in Buddhism, because they're not random. They're there because the Buddha felt that they would be helpful for us. And it's got this really lovely confidence. By choosing what you do with your awareness and attending to things skillfully, you will progress on the path. Yeah. But first of all, you need to know what's happening. So a big, big part of the sutta is just coming closer to what is actually happening right now. So a lot of the practice we do this week will be simply waking up to what are you experiencing without judgment. That's very, very important that we let go of that automatic, I shouldn't be having this experience. Because guess what? You are having it. So how can you just meet it with kindness, with equanimity, with acceptance, and then to let it go? Yeah. It's interesting, actually, in terms of our culture. Quite regularly, the Dalai Lama meets with Western scientists in a meeting called the Mind and Life Institute. Started years ago. And Sharon Salzberg, who's a lot of you all know, she's a Buddhist teacher in America who's written a lot about loving kindness and so on. And she asked the Dalai Lama about working with self-hatred, I think it was. And he really couldn't understand the question. And at first he thought, people thought it was a translation issue. And then eventually, he really didn't understand the question. Because it seems quite a Western phenomenon. This self-hatred, this being hard on ourselves, this kind of self-denigration. He wasn't familiar with that. As a kind of widely experienced state of mind. Isn't it interesting that in that culture, self-hatred, the way we have it, just doesn't exist? And I don't know, you know, we could speculate about why we have it. There's probably lots of reasons, Christian conditioning, all kinds of other things. It doesn't really matter why we have, the fact is we do have it. And which is why I think this particular text needs to be handled with care and but needs to be held by a huge amount of kindness and acceptance for us. Because you could use it in quite a nihilistic way and just give yourself a hard time for the next 10 days every time you have a negative mental event. And we don't want you to do that. We want the opposite. We want you to come to terms with, this is my human mind. That's all it is. It's just a human mind. It's not a particularly bad one or a particularly good one. It's just a human mind. How can I love it? How can I care for it? And how can I liberate it? Yeah. So we're going to be doing metta as well as the mindfulness. And we're going to be really bringing the Buddha center stage as an object of devotion. So we've got something to move towards. So we're not just moving away from our reactive states and possibly just brewing self-hatred for 10 days. But we're going to be placing everything at the feet of the Buddha. He was a human being like us through his own efforts. He freed his mind. We too can do that. And devotion is such a heart-opening experience. And it's an antidote to what can become a very heady practice. You're just kind of watching. We don't want that. We want to be fully embodied, passionate, loving, adoring the Buddha. We want you to adore the Buddha this week as a kind of symbol of your own potential. Okay, so we'll leave it there. Are there any questions?
It's this. In the... I could appreciate what you felt yourself about Vedana. Not from intended that. I could appreciate what you... your misgivings about the meaning and how it's usually translated, because I've struggled for years as well to really get that word.
Yeah.
So on. But now when... So I really liked that when you said that. I felt a bit relieved. But I notice in this plan a new thing that I'm worried about now, which is there are two things that I know there's a multiplicity of things going on at all times. But here we have we've got the materialistic worldly Vedana on the left, and if we just allow that to proliferate, we will go into the worldly Chitta responses. But on the other hand, if we're so advanced, if you like, that the Vedana isn't that grasping, angry kind. It's more or less the Vedana itself has become developed. Then it's quite easy to see that, well, I can't imagine it, but that you'll end up with the higher and worldly results, inevitable results.
Yeah.
But look at this. It looks here as if you can actually force yourself to go from the materialistic worldly Vedana along this blue arrow, which I have a picture in my mind. This
Good.
Blue arrow. And almost say, okay, my Vedana are really quite nasty. I'm really not very nice. But if I don't cultivate them, I can move towards the more positive chitta that really belongs in the spiritual unworldly.
Okay, that's an excellent question.
You understand it?
I totally understand. I totally understand it.
Thank you.
And it prompts me to have a word of warning about maps. Yeah. So this is So I've done this because some of us are visual learners, and it helps me understand. Yeah. But this looks very neat, doesn't it? I have my body. I have a Vedana. I have a Chitta. Here is a hindrance. Here is Bodhiyanga's awakening factors. Of course, life is not like that. Life is a torrent. Yeah, it's like a waterfall of every single moment we've got body, Vedana, Chitta, hindrances, awakening factors, all just happening like chaos in there, isn't it? Yeah. In fact, a waterfall is a good analogy. And one way we can think of sati is you're sitting on a ledge behind the waterfall. So the waterfall's just pouring down, but we're no longer in the waterfall getting carried away. We're just watching it, yeah?
I've actually done that.
Have you?
Yeah.
So that's lovely. So you can think of that during the retreat.
Scared, yeah.
Yeah, and that might actually be that little arrow, possibly.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of them.
Yeah. So sitting behind Niagara Falls is sitting in that little arrow. So let's just think about what it's actually like together. So here you are, you're sitting in meditation. Your knee's really hurting. You've got an unpleasant Vedana. Yeah? You have an arising of tension. You have a mental state of, when is the bell going to go? Yeah? How many of us have had that? You're just longing for the bell. And you catch that. So you're already into chitta because you're having a kind of aversion response. You catch that, drop back to your body, your knee's hurting, and you soften, you relax. You note, I'm just having a mental event of aversion here. Here's my knee's hurting. It's a flow of sensations. It's not me and my knee at all. It's just an experience, a flow of sensations. I'm just going to rest there. You're making these choices, you rest there. And then there's a kind of softening, and your heart starts to open a wee bit, yeah? And then you're into more expansive chitta. That's that little blue arrow, non-reactive awareness. Your knee's still hurting. There's still the temptation to go into just ranting for the next 20 minutes about how dare they have such a long meditation, and why won't they ring that bell? I'm sure we've all been there. And I hate this retreat, and why did I come? Yeah, so you got that choice. You've also got the choice of catching it at any moment and driving a wedge through that stream of negative mental events. Driving a stream through, it's another moment of body Vedana. Like, we've got body and Vedana arising all the time. So it's not as if we've only got one moment of choice. In fact, this label of the gap, I've never been that happy about that either. Well, it's a bit like if you miss the gap, well, you've had it, you know, and you're way, you're a crew or something. But a moment of responsive awareness as how I prefer to talk about the gap, a moment of responsive awareness. And every moment is an opportunity for another moment of responsive awareness. And every time we choose not to react to the unpleasant Vedana, or it might be desire, you might be sitting there thinking about lunch, which is another favourite of many of us. What's for lunch today? We had celery and cashew yesterday, so we'll be there today. So what's the rest of the menu at Taraloka? What should we have today? So you've got desire. You catch it. I'm just thinking about lunch. Why am I thinking about lunch? You know, that's ridiculous. Here I am meditating. I've got this opportunity. Come on, come back. Drop into the breath. Drop into the body. And then, little opening somewhere. Rest there. Seeds of release. Rest in the opening heart. Breathe. Metta. Here I am. I'm just loving myself. I'm loving everyone else. And you're into the higher chitta. Just like that. Yeah, so does that make sense?
Yes.
So I'm really glad you asked that question, because this looks kind of static, but it's just, every moment's a new chance. And even if we've got this unpleasant Vedana going on, of physical pain, which we'll all have physical pain at some point during this week, I'm afraid to say, we've got a choice how we respond to it. And if we can soften around physical pain, interestingly, we can get in quite expansive emotional states.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just thinking, sometimes it might arise that for whatever reasons you're in just too much discomfort for what might occur, then you have a choice, don't you, surely, to then make a decision about moving.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. Thank you. Yeah, and that's another really interesting awareness practice. Mm-hmm. Yeah, making that decision about when we're restless because of a mental state. And just being still would be a good practice for us. And when we're restless, because actually we really need to move. And if we feel we need to move, then of course we want you to move. We don't mind what's happening in the shrine room on this retreat. We're not trying to create some perfect calm, because then some of us will be really rigid if we suggest you do that. If you're really sleepy, I would encourage you to stand up. We don't mind you standing up in the middle of meditation. And you will wake up, because it's further to fall. So it does work. There's a high motivation. You've got more reason to wake up if you're standing up. This whole way of practice is about having a soft mind. A soft, receptive, poised, gentle, pliable mind. And if you're sitting there rigid with discomfort, that's not going to give you a soft mind. The big thing is making a conscious choice. So mindfulness, the Satipatthana practices, is making conscious choices, not being driven by habitual responses. And our habitual response might be to go rigid, or our habitual response might be to fidget. And if your habitual response is fidgeting, then it might be interesting for you to experiment with being still. If your habitual response is to go rigid, then for you, moving will be really good. Yeah. So we're just putting ourselves in the lab, really. It's like a laboratory for the mind and the body and the heart for 10 days. But it's really loving. So it's a big red lab. And it's got love pouring out of the walls. And just we're being bathed in this love all the time while we kind of really look into our experience and examine it.